find myself in a little bit of a conundrum this evening. We are going to get back into our study of 1 Samuel, and really to some degree it is a study of the life of David, or in its broad sense, we've been following a history of Israel, Old Testament Israel, all the way from Moses up until the moment where we are now. But next Sunday night, you're going to have a guest preacher. My parents are coming into town for the Bible conference in Lyons, and so I asked my father if he would speak for us next Sunday night. So you'll get to hear some good preaching for a change if you're here next Sunday night. But then the following week, 2 weeks from today, is homecoming. Thank you very much. And so we won't have an evening service. And so I want to introduce tonight this 22nd chapter, but it's more than I want to do in one setting, in one service. But I don't want to go another week without talking about it, because we didn't deal with it last week, and that would put us a full month in between it. So let's get back into it tonight, refamiliarize ourselves with it, look, if we can, at just part of this chapter, and then the Lord willing, it'll be 3 weeks from tonight, but the Lord willing, when we get back together on Sunday night, we'll pick up from here. So, 1 Samuel, chapter number 22, and I would like you to follow along as we read the first five verses. The first five verses. In 1 Samuel 22, God's word says, David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam, and when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. And the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold, depart and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. Tonight I simply would entitle our study, A Fugitive from Injustice. A fugitive from injustice. The familiar phrase, of course, would be a fugitive from justice, but David really hasn't done anything wrong. He has been an honorable servant to King Saul, and so he is now a fugitive. And in fact, I know it's been a little while, so let me put your mind back there. Remember, Saul has made numerous attempts to take David's life, both overtly and covertly, from really trying to manipulate people to have him assassinated, to Saul himself throwing javelins trying to kill David. And so David is he's a man on the run. He is a fugitive. He is in flight. He is running literally for his life. And if you will remember in the last chapter, as we gathered together last time and discussed this, when we were together, David and Jonathan had met, covenanted together. Jonathan tells David, my father is going to kill you. Saul is going to kill you. So David flees. And if you'll remember, he goes to this little village of Nob. And there's where the priest is. And while he is there, David lies to the priest. You remember he says, I'm on this top secret mission for King Saul. Nobody knows I'm here. And of course, that was all an untruth. That was not the story really at all. And so he ends up lying to the priest, Ahimelech. But the priest, if you will remember, gives David both some food, and he also gives him the sword of Goliath. And David departs from there, and of all the crazy places that he could possibly go, David goes to Gath, the hometown of Goliath. And I don't know whether he thought he was going to hide, but it didn't work out for him. Immediately upon his arrival there, they mark him. You know, when you're carrying Goliath's sword, that's sort of a dead giveaway, right? So anyway, they mark him. And you remember what David does? He pretends to be loony, to be crazy. And in fact, the last time that we were in this study, we said that David was a man on the run from God. But somewhere in between this, when he leaves from Gath, the land of the Philistines, and this, his departure really running from God, overcome with fear, somewhere between that and tonight, David's faith is restored. His confidence is restored. He is like the proverbial backslidden sinner who gets right with the Lord. He had gone down this road, the same road that many of us have been on, of turning away from God, getting involved in sin, and then next thing you know, he doesn't even recognize himself as he's acting a nut in Gath. However, he comes to his senses, like the prodigal. He comes to his senses, and now we see him restored, acting like the David that we know and love. And as we turn to the narrative tonight, David is still on the run, but he's not on the run from God. And there is the important part of that. He has traveled from Gibeah in flight from Saul to Nob, from Nob to Gath, from Gath to a cave. And in our text tonight, he'll go from a cave all the way over to Moab, and then he'll turn around and go from Moab all the way back to the land of Judah. So get it. He's a man on the run. He's a man on the go. He is a fugitive from injustice. And I would like you to notice just a few things. There are only five verses, so I know you're getting excited, right? Nobody complains about short sermons. And since I'm so long this morning, maybe I owe you one. But nonetheless, I want you to notice, the first thing I would ask you to notice with me is that in the narrative tonight, David gathers a crowd. As he departs, verse 1, he escapes to this cave that is really in the heart of Israel. It's not far, some 10 or 12 miles, it is thought by most scholars, 10 or 12 miles south of Bethlehem. And when he is there, his brethren, that is his brothers, come to him. His father's house, the house of Jesse, his parents come to him. But not only that, in verse 2, notice the folks that begin to gather around David. Those who were in distress, those who were in debt, and all that were discontented. Now, I say this with a certain measure of jest. And don't get mad because it's half a joke. But there is some debate among scholars, and not so much in my opinion, but there's some debate among scholars as to whether or not the church existed in the Old Testament. And you see where I'm going, don't you? I always thought the church is not in the Old Testament, but then I found it right there in verse number 2. All of those who were in distress, all of those who were in debt, and all who were discontented. Now that sounds like a church to me. Now don't get mad, it's a half a joke, but let me just develop that a little bit, okay? So here's the deal. Saul has been reigning now for over 30 years. And we've got to piece some things together from the narrative both here and the things that we've studied in the past. You remember when Israel first demanded a king, Samuel's warning to them, you want a king, but let me tell you what a king is going to do. A king's going to, he's going to take your sons and your daughters. He's going to tax you. He's going to come and he's going to reap from your fields. I mean, life's not going to be as grand as you think it is under the dominion of a king. And so it seems like, as we piece things together, it seems like Saul had done exactly what Samuel said was going to happen. He began to tax the people heavily. He began to assimilate them into his army. those who got themselves into debt. They were forced into a measure of slavery or servanthood. In other words, 3 decades of Saul's reign and the nation of Israel is just not very strong. It seems like Saul is just not a very good king. He was a good soldier. And in all honesty, he had a great start. How humble he was. This is the same guy that when they were trying to anoint him king, remember, he was hiding among the stuff. He didn't want to be the king. But now, all of a sudden, he is, and I think it's okay to say this, he has some real mental health issues. He has this wicked spirit that comes on him from time to time, and he just seems to be a very poor leader. And rather than running the country, he seems to be obsessed with killing David. In fact, as you get more into this narrative, we'll get back into the chapter a little bit further, his whole mindset is, how can I kill David? So rather than leading the nation and leading it well, he has people who are turning against him. They are in debt. They are in distress. And they are discontent. Right there is an inspired, alliterated outline. Some of you ought to be really loving that right there. People in debt and discontent and in distress, they gather around him. So these are not the who's who of Israel. You understand? These are not the top tier of the Hebrew ladder. These are people who are probably pretty well fed up with Saul's reign. Some who are on the verge of being sold into slavery. Some who have probably been mistreated and maltreated by Saul or those within his kingdom. And so having been fed up with that, they are drawn to Israel's future king, King David. And so they gather together around him. And so as we study this narrative, I want to continue to remind you that David is merely a portrait. Now, David, a godly man, we learn much from him. But David would have us point towards the son of David. David would have us take notice of the true king of Israel, King Jesus. And if you will think about this, who was it that gathered around Jesus, Israel's true king? Was it world leaders? Was it primarily those who were rich and famous? Or was it those who were in debt, those who were in distress, and those who were discontented? In this Old Testament narrative, we see the sort of rejects and ragtag bunch that gathers around King David. In the New Testament, we see that it is the rejects and a ragtag bunch that gather around King Jesus. We don't have what you might call among us a bunch of movers and shakers. Among our own church family, there's not many of us who are rich, wealthy. We're not a who's who even in Perry, let alone in the state of Georgia, right? But notice this in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26, it says, "For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and the base things, and things which are despised, and things which are not." King David would take this nucleus, what would amount to 400 people, and it's going to grow. But King David would take that nucleus of rejects and the offscouring, and he would build a kingdom from it. Think that'll preach? In the New Testament, Jesus took that nucleus of ragtags and rejects. You say, well, preacher, were they the offscouring? Well, you had fishermen, Peter, Andrew. You had a tax collector. You had Mary Magdalene, who had a little trouble with demon possession prior to her conversion. And so Jesus gathers that ragtag bunch of people who are in debt and discontent and are in despair and in trouble. Jesus gathers that bunch right there, and they become the nucleus of His kingdom. David takes this little bunch right here, and he builds an empire from it. Jesus took that little bunch around Him, and the New Testament says they turned the world upside down. So when we read about David, learn from it, but don't forget that there's also a lesson to be learned about the son of David, one who is even greater than the one we're reading about tonight. So he has gathered a crowd around him, and to some degree they just sort of gather around. He is, I think, a magnetic personality. He is a man, and we studied last time about some of his weakness and a moment of weakness of his. But remember, he's a guy who went toe to toe with Goliath. He was well known as a brave, courageous soldier. Just like all of us, he had his moments. We looked at that. But now these people begin to gather around him. But not only does David gather a crowd, but I would have you notice also that David guards his family. David guards his family. So in this 22nd chapter, and you'll see this more the next time we study it, King Saul conducts himself in a very cruel, sadistic, satanic way. And I mean that. He conducts himself in an ungodly way. And so we have, in this narrative, we have David who points us towards the Son of David, the Lord Jesus Christ. And we have Saul who sort of portrays Satan in this. And there is an epic battle going on of good and evil. And it seems very clear to me, at least, that Saul was so obsessed and incensed with having David killed that David's own family was in fear for their life. Now remember, Saul had already tried to kill his own son. Remember, he tried to sling a spear, tried to kill Jonathan because he learned that Jonathan was covenanting with David. So it becomes evident to me that Saul is not above this disturbed, emotional, obsessed man is not above punishing David's family in order to get to David. And so when his family hear that David has fled to this cave and he is dwelling in this cave, they come to him. Jesse, whoever his wife is, David's mother, his brethren, they all gather together around him. But David realizes they're not safe there. And so David makes a difficult pilgrimage east. Southeast goes down. Moab is on the other side. And I'm looking at it from my way. So you got to backwards it, okay? Reverse it. Backwards it. You got to reverse it. And y'all still write me a check every month. Isn't it wonderful? I appreciate it. So Moab is on the east side of the Dead Sea. I've been there. That's an arduous journey, and I was in a bus when we did it, okay? He gathers probably what his elderly family. He begins to go way down. The Dead Sea is the lowest point, you know, below sea level on dry land on the planet. Lowest point below sea level that is on dry land on the planet. So he takes his family down from the mountains and caves of Adullam, travels some 3,000 feet down into the Dead Sea Valley, then takes them back up to Mizpah of Moab. And the Moabites are enemies of Saul. So they share a common enemy, if you will. Saul's trying to kill David. The Moabites are at war with Saul. So David takes his family, guards them, protects them under the reign of the king of Moab. But not only do they share a common enemy, there's also some ancestry that plays into this. David's great-grandmother was a lady by the name of Ruth, the Moabitess. And so I think it is both the fact that they have a common enemy and also the fact that they have a common ancestry. David takes his family to the king of Moab. You know, this would be very, very... it would be very unlikely, except given the circumstance. He takes his family there and asks the king of Moab to safeguard his family. And so there he guards and protects them. David's great-grandmother, Ruth, who had committed herself to following after Naomi. But again, why does he go to such an extreme to protect his family? Because there is an enemy after them. And I would simply say this as we continue to draw parallels. We also have an enemy and he is real. And he is after your family. He wants to destroy your family. We have, you know, sometimes we forget about this, but we are in the midst of a spiritual battle. We're in a warfare. We're to take unto us the whole armor of God. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of darkness and wickedness in high places. We're in a battle right now. We're in a warfare right now, and we have an enemy. And that enemy is obsessed with destroying the kingdom of God, tearing down the kingdom of Israel's true anointed Messiah. And in order to do that, if he can tear your family down, he will. He will. And so let us learn from David that we too need to guard our family. We need to protect them from the wiles of Satan, not to be unaware or ignorant of his devices. We need to try to guard and protect them in any way we can, up to and including teaching our young family, teaching our little ones about a godly heritage. I don't think David was surprised to get to Moab and find out he was kin to him. I think he'd been taught that. He knew that he had been trained, even as a child, of the faithfulness of his great-grandmother. And part of our guiding and guarding our young people is to remind them of the godly heritage that is in many of their own families. But I'm also reminded of one thing, and this is just sort of a side point, if you will, but I like it. David wanted to make sure his mother and father were protected. He was honoring the fifth command, am I right there? Honor your father and mother. He was doing that by seeing that they were protected. But do you remember some of the very last words of Jesus? As he hung on the cross, he wanted to make sure his mother was going to be taken care of. He says to her, "Mother, behold your son." He's talking about John that's standing right there by them. "John, behold, this is your son. John, behold your mother." So as David would guide and guard his family, even in the last moments that our Messiah, that the son of David had on earth, he would guard and protect his family and honor the fifth command. And then thirdly, not only has he guarded his family, and this is important, and I need to point this out to you, the close of verse number 3, I want you to notice this little phrase, but it's a big phrase. He's talking to the king of Moab. He says, "Let my family stay with you." Notice this little phrase, "till I know what God will do for me." There it is. He's not, He's not out of the will of God. He's not running from God. Right now he is saying, I want to know what God's going to do. Until I know God's will and God's direction for me, I need you to look after them. And so then he gathers a crowd. He guards his family. But the third thing this evening is simply, David goes where he's told. And that is in verse number 5, we are introduced to the prophet Gad. Gad is a new character on the scene for us, but he is a godly man. He will become a key component in David's kingdom. He becomes what the Bible calls David's seer, S-E-E-R, his prophet, his seer. He becomes in the inner circle, a counselor to David, a prophet to David, solid biblical counsel for David. And so Gad says to him, David, hiding in the cave is no place for Israel's future king. You need to get on back to the land of Judah. And again, these things seem almost insignificant or trivial. But folks, when it's all said and done, to trust and obey carries you a long way when pleasing God. Verse 5, he says, Gad says unto him, don't abide in the hold, depart and get into the land of Judah. And David departed. He didn't make excuses. He didn't say, okay, maybe. He got up and left, and he went when he was commanded. Obviously, we see a revival has taken place in the heart of David. Remember, we don't know any exact dates, weeks, months. We just don't know. But he's gone from lying to the priest to acting as if he's out of his mind in Gath, allowing his own saliva to dribble down his beard and just, you know, clawing at the walls, acting a nut. He's gone from that to now he's saying, I just want to know what God's going to do me, what direction God is going to send me. And when God's prophet says go, he goes. And listen, that shows, right? That shows that there's been a change in his heart. When he goes from being in fear to now he is acting in faith. So David's renewed faith and his recommitment here, even in the face of injustice. Get this. He is still a fugitive from injustice. But he is now acting in faith and showing himself courageous. David's renewed faith, David's renewed commitment, even in the face of the injustices done to him, should encourage us, should provide a challenge to us, that we would abide faithful as well. Now I want to share something with you before we dismiss, because again, this is something that I think will help you. And if you want to, turn to Psalms chapter number 57. And don't think I'm preaching another sermon. I'm not. Just follow me just a moment if you would. We've done this the last several times as we begin to realize. Remember, David wrote somewhere between a third and a half of the Psalms. I could be corrected on an exact number. But these Psalms were written at key points in his life. And as we read the superscription of Psalms 57, it says, to the chief musician at Laschith, that this is a miktum of David. And even the best of biblical minds don't know what a miktum is. The best guess is that it has to do with an engraving. Again, these superscriptions are not inspired. However, they are reliable. And when it says a miktum, you'll see this through Psalms, the early 50 Psalms. The idea is that it's thought that the idea is that this was a psalm that was engraven immediately, chiseled in stone, if you will, because of its value. And so anyway, it was a miktum of David, but notice, when he fled from Saul in the cave. So again, that superscription is not inspired, but it is considered to be very reliable. And in this 57th psalm, he pleads to God for mercy. Be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Do you see the transformation in him from 1 Samuel 21 to 1 Samuel 22? Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpassed. I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performeth all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net. Do you see how real this is to David? As he has fled for his life, but he's turned again to God. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit for me. Into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves. My heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. Awake up, my glory. Awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto thee among the nations. For thy mercy is great under the heavens, and thy truth under the clouds. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. That's quite a transformation from a man that had slobber hanging off his beard not that long ago in Gath. From someone that was lying to the priest of God. What a transformation this is. See this. This is real to David. And remember, these psalms, they're not just random songs. These come from the life experiences of those who were involved in this. And it is thought as well, and I will just give this to you, that Psalms, the 142nd, Psalms 142, is also written at this same time period. Now, David spends more than one occasion in a cave. So we can't be definitive about this, but the Hebrew scholars say that these are reliable. David is a fugitive from injustice, but he is still under the protective hand of the Almighty. Things seem very bleak for David. Yet God is working. He's gathering these people unto him. They are committing themselves to him. David is just on his way to becoming what Samuel has anointed him to become. Let me remind you, David will spend about 10 years on the run, about 10 years as a fugitive. But all of that time, God's protective hand is over him. Be reminded, be mindful, that God, just as surely as he looked after David, he's looking after you and I also. You and I also. All right.